Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to episode 2 of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's weekly awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and I'm very happy to be joined here at the Toronto International Film Festival by our executive editor and the guy who's led all of our coverage here at the fest, Matt Bellany. Thank you for coming in.
No problem. Good afternoon.
Matt, in just a few minutes, we're going to go to an interview that I did here today with Eddie Redmayne, the star of The Danish Girl, which is one of the most talked about movies at the fest. But before we do that, I think we should maybe give people a little bit of a recap about just the whole scene here and what sort of come out better and worse than before it came here. And so from your point of view, where should we begin?
Well, I think, you know, what's interesting about Toronto, obviously, in addition to the great movies you see, everyone starts talking about the awards race. It is the unofficial kickoff of awards season. And I think about midway through the festival, we are getting a sense of the big contenders. I mean, you have the ones that premiered at Venice and Telluride, like Black Mass and Spotlight. Steve Jobs, which is not here, is probably still in the conversation as well. But then you have some movies that premiered here. I think Cate Blanchett is definitely a contender for Truth, the Dan Rather movie. I don't know if that movie is going to go the distance, but she certainly is amazing in the film. And I think there are some others as well. What is your impression?
Well, you know, I've been surprised by a number of things. The Martian, which I thought might just be a purely commercial movie, may have some awards prospects. It's Ridley Scott's sort of big comeback in a way. This guy hasn't been really on his game since Gladiator, which is already 15 years ago. And yet here he's back, and Matt Damon gives a very winning performance in that. We've seen a number of other more performance possibilities, not necessarily movies. So whether it's Bryan Cranston in Trumbo, or Tom Hiddleston in I Saw the Light, or many others.
I didn't see I Saw the Light, but the reviews were not great. So you think Hiddleston is still a contender?
You don't want to totally write somebody off because the movie doesn't work, because I think, you know, there many people felt the same way about whether it was Crazy Heart, and yet Jeff Bridges came out with
it. This is the Hank Williams biopic that was screened here over the weekend.
Exactly, and the movie definitely has its problems. The same, you know, there are certainly issues with Free Held, for instance, another one that just premiered here.
That's the Julianne Moore, Ellen Page, lesbian domestic benefits movie.
Yes, set way in the past 10 years ago, and it shows, in a lot of ways how far things have come, but, in the movie is not flawless at all, and yet Julianne Moore, as a woman dying of cancer, trying to kind of hold on to some rights that heterosexual people would get, is very powerful as always, and so, I think the big thing, though, is that we have not come away from either Telluride or Toronto or the others that you mentioned, Sundance, Venice, Cannes, with a movie that is the clear frontrunner in the way that in most of the last few years we felt that we've seen the probable best picture by this point. Do you agree?
I completely agree. I think there's a lot of movies here and at the other festivals so far that people like. I'm not hearing something that is getting universal praise as something everyone loves.
Right.
So the fact that there isn't a clear front runner actually makes it a more interesting Oscar race, because the best movie of the year is maybe still to come, or one of these movies could gain traction and sort of go the distance.
Right.
I really can't tell at this point.
No, it's fascinating. And, you know, we head from here to the New York Film Festival in just a few days from now, where The Walk, which is Robert Zemeckis' movie about the guy that walked between the World Trade Centers, that's opening the fest. That's a possibility. Steve Jobs will get its big unveiling there. So maybe, you know, that could kickstart things again for that. And then, you know, but what I found interesting is that this year, a lot of the most anticipated titles are being held till quite late in the season. I mean, on Christmas Day alone, we have Joy, the David O. Russell reunion with Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence. We have Concussion with Will Smith. We have The Revenant with Leonardo DiCaprio and last year's Best Director winner, Alejandro González Iñárritu.
And don't forget Star Wars.
And Star Wars, of course, as well. And
people forget that Star Wars, the original 1977 film, got a Best Picture nomination.
And many others. And I totally agree with you. I think that people are hungry for a reboot in a sense of this franchise. The last three were so disappointing for most people, and to have now J.J. Abrams and a cast of some of the best young actors in the business, Oscar Isaac, John Boyega, all kinds of people in this, I'm optimistic.
I'm cautiously optimistic. Yeah. I think that it would take a lot. This movie has to be really good to get a Best Picture nomination. But people also forget that J.J. Abrams' last reboot, Star Trek, got a Producers Guild nomination for Best Picture.
Which
it didn't get the Best Picture Oscar nomination, but there is some precedent here. So,
and I think
knows?
That when you get that PGA nom, that means you were probably not that far from the picture nom. And so it's it's plausible, I think.
And I think a lot of people in the industry are rooting for Star Wars. They want it to be good. They want it to do gigantic business. Right. They really see it as a shot in the arm for the industry. And a lot of times those movies, whether it's Titanic or Avatar, you know, the big blockbuster that appeals to the entire world, does score a Best Picture nomination.
Well, absolutely. And if it does, that would be great news, not only for Disney stockholders, but also for ABC, which is hoping to rebound from the lowest ratings in years of this last at this last telecast with Neil Patrick Harris as the host. But I mean, I guess the question that people probably wonder is, if the Oscars were held tomorrow, based on what we've seen right now, what do you think would be the winner?
The winner?
Yes.
Oh, I have no idea. But I think if you're looking at nominations for Best Picture right now, you'd probably have to include Spotlight. You'd probably include Black Mass.
Mm-hmm.
You would probably include maybe Steve Jobs, just based on the reaction out of Telluride. But again, it's so early.
Well, I'll add one more to that list, because it's the one we're going to be talking about for the rest of this podcast, and that is The Danish Girl, which is a movie that stars Eddie Redmayne, who less than a year ago, really barely 6 months ago, was standing in front of the world as the Best Actor winner for The Theory of Everything, playing Stephen Hawking. This time he is back with Tom Hooper, who directed him on TV in Elizabeth I and in the movies in Les Miserables, which was a Best Picture nominee. This time he's playing a trans person in 1920s Copenhagen. And obviously this couldn't have been planned, but the timing of this movie coincides with the society really looking at this issue, whether it's in Transparent on TV or Caitlyn Jenner or Laverne Cox or all kinds of things. There's a
Tangerine,
yes, which was a very interesting movie shot entirely on iPhones, dealing with trans people in present day Los Angeles. So it's obviously a hot button topic. And what I can tell you is that based on its premiere, which I think you may have been at as well here in Toronto, in the same theater, by the way, as Theory of Everything had its North American premiere a year ago, people are going crazy, not only for the movie, but about the idea that Eddie Redmayne could be the first person to win back-to-back Best Actor Oscars since Tom Hanks did it 20-something years ago for Philadelphia and Forrest Gump, which is high praise.
Yeah, let's get to your interview.
Let's do it. Eddie Redmayne, thank you so much for doing this. And I have to say that before we really get into it, one of the sad things about what I do, I feel, is that you go through a season, you kind of cover somebody from start to finish, you get to know them a little bit, you interview them, you get a sense of who they are, and then usually it's at least a few years that go by before you see them again, and sometimes you never see them again because their ambitions change, their focus changes. Sometimes it's just hard to recapture the magic, and yet here we are, just a few months after you were up there in front of the world accepting the Best Actor Oscar for The Theory of Everything, and we're here again. So how is this possible? How did you make this happen?
Oh God. do you know what? I basically this film, The Danish Girl, this script has, I think, it's been around for 15 years, and I was given the script when I was making Les Miserables with Tom Hooper. And he sort of passed me this brown envelope and said, "Will you have a read of this?" And I read it and was so, so extraordinarily moved by it. It was this incredibly beautiful love story and story of authenticity. And immediately I said, I think I said, I don't think he'd even offered it to me. I was like, I'll do it. And he's like, mate, you're totally not financeable. But I will. I was like, oh, right, sorry. Well, why did you give it to me to read? But I... anyway, so I became attached to it, but the film had taken at that point 12 years and it never got financing, and so I sort of remained loosely attached to it, and then I got Theory of Everything, and then Tom suddenly got the financing, and the extraordinary thing about film is you have no control, you don't know when the right time is. Alicia was cast, but then because she was making a Derek Cierfrance film, we had to push when we started filming, and so it ended up that we started making this film at the time while I was sort of still promoting Theory, and it's all just there's no method in anything. The whole thing is a sort of weird, bizarre.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I remember talking to you during the whole circuit for Theory of Everything, when also, by the way, you were having to prepare to get married, right? It must have just been absolutely insane. How did you have even the ability to focus to make this movie, let alone make it well, when all of that was happening around you?
Well, I suppose because it had been a project that I'd been with for 3 years, there's a certain amount of sort of longer term investigation that I started doing. But also on Tom's counsel, really, I tried to make the amount of travelling that Felicity and I were doing promoting Theory of Everything, push it into its... or basically use it to meet women from the trans community, both in New York, in Los Angeles, and in London, to try and get us meet people of different generations, different sort of parts of the world, and try and get as much sort of educate myself as much as I possibly could. And weirdly, it was wonderful because promoting a film was so different to making it. Mm-hmm. It was actually a very wonderful thing that every day I could go back to my room and focus on the actual work rather than just talking about the work.
That's so interesting. So as you look back, though, you know, again, we're obviously going to mainly focus on Danish Girl, but as you look back at that whole experience of the past year, because a lot has happened in the year since the first time let's just say, both Theory of Everything and Danish Girl premiered in North America at the same theater, at the same festival, with the same production company, working title, right, same distributor focus. So, but in between... so much has happened in your life, and I just wonder, as you look back on the past year, how you kind of process it. What were the and particularly, obviously, the I would imagine the crowning moment in a sense at the Oscars, where it all was recognized.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose for me personally, I got married in the middle of it. That was the most wonderful thing. And again, none of it was all sort of. So that was the most extraordinary thing, and everything sort of settled around it. I mean, what's also is I'm not sure I've really processed it, if I'm being honest. You put one foot in front of the other, and from we were making Danish Girl when the Academy Awards happened, and so I left on a Friday night from set and came back on Monday and was back working, and again, so the moment felt like a mirage. Yeah. It was this extraordinarily frenzied, wonderful moment, but I sort of adrenaline and alcohol fueled. Right. I suppose it's only in the it's still now that you basically consistently pinching yourself.
Sure. Well, and you remember that there was that David Niven book where I just have to bring it back because this was a guy who 50 years ago was saying. Similar thing to what you've just said. This is like surreal. I can't, and especially as I guess a Brit coming in and kind of popping in and out of what's going on. I think he kind of implied that it was almost like a mirage, an illusion, or something.
But. I think it is, but it also, I don't know. One of the things I find interesting about filmmaking is the amount of money involved. Like you know, certainly when I was playing Stephen Hawking. You were aware that the film was costing $15 million. Now, for me, that is like beyond... And you feel responsibility of that. Mm-hmm. And so when you're promoting the film, you feel a responsibility to sort of get it out into the world. And certainly with how long that promotion was, you see people investing in the film and advertising it more and doing all that. And I think that sort of the pressure sort of ratchets up as that you go from being an actor and a performer to being someone who is out there trying to encourage people to go see that film. Now it's so much easier in both the case of the Danish Girl and Theory of Everything, where it's something you believe in, and you just sort of count your lucky stars because that doesn't always happen.
Well, but so in full candor though, what's the most trying part of it all? Just answering the same question a million times, or the travel, or what?
What's the most trying part of it? I suppose that the thing I find most trying is not trying is the wrong word, but it's just the first time your film's being seen. Mm-hmm. I found, because you've particularly with this one, it's, as I say, it was 15 years in the making. For me, it was 3 years of work, and suddenly this thing is and it's made, you make it, it's a passion project, and it's something that's made by a collection of people, and suddenly this thing is going out into the world to be judged, and the mixture of talking about it and having to deal with people's responses to it, I find that pretty
Well, I imagine hard. Especially when you're as you did in The Theory of Everything and The Danish Girl, when you're having to make yourself so vulnerable in different ways, physically having to reinvent yourself in theory, in this case, obviously as well. I mean, it just you kind of is that the first time you really get a sense of whether or not you've pulled it off?
I think so. I mean, for Theory, it was the stakes that what would Stephen and Jane and Jonathan think, and for me here, it's Lily was an extraordinary woman and an icon of the trans community and someone who's and a pioneer, and it was whilst prepping to play the part, I met at the generosity of the trans community, or the people that I met towards me was overwhelming. But with that came a great responsibility to try and tell her story as authentically as I could. And so here, it's for me, it's what do members of the community think, and you want to do her story, probably. Mm-hmm.
Well, I imagine, I believe this is the third time you and Tom Hooper have worked together. The first, I believe, was Elizabeth the First for TV, then Les Mis, as we mentioned, and now this. But does the fact that it is somebody that you have a certain comfort level with make that easier? And then also to if I can just prompt you to share one story that I've always found very funny. I'm sorry, because I'm sure it's a millionth time, but just how this great collaboration actually started with Tom.
Yeah.
It wasn't always destined to look like this.
It definitely wasn't. No, so I met Tom auditioning for Elizabeth the First. I think it was my first or second thing ever in front of camera. And it was with Helen Mirren and Jeremy Irons. And I remember I was in this audition. I'd met him once, and I'd come back for a second audition. And just as it was to play the Earl of Southampton, who was a sort of very decadent, quite fey man, and quite ostentatious guy. And as I was leaving the audition, Tom said, "One last thing, Eddie. Have you ever been on a horse?" And I said, "Yes," not admitting that I'd literally been sort of walked around a paddock aged four, was I? And anyway, I thought that's what actors do. You hear that, can you tap dance? Of course I can. But no one had taught me the bit in between, which is that between lying and getting the part, you then, or getting on set, you go and learn how to do those things. Anyway, so about 2 weeks later, we shot the miniseries in Lithuania, and there was this scene where Hugh Dancy and I were staging this gigantic coup against Helen Mirren. So it's this huge Elizabethan street in Lithuania, about 100 Lithuanian horse stuntmen, carriages, rain machines, Helen Mirren, Jeremy Irons up on a balcony at the end, Tom up there, and I'm having spurs attached to my feet. I'm on this gigantic stallion, and I'm going, what point do I admit that I have never been on a horse other than being water? And I was too embarrassed to admit it, and so they called action. I was meant to be riding behind Hugh, and they called action, and I sort of gave my horse a gentle nudge, and he went off at 100 miles an hour. I had to cover my eyes. I was just clinging on. And they had to pull the rain machines out. People were almost it was really dangerous. People were almost hurt. And anyway, Tom appeared from behind Helen Mirren in a huge, beautiful Elizabethan dress with a tannoy, a big loudspeaker, and just said, "You're a fucking liar, Redmayne." So it was bad. It really was a bad start. But from there, it could only go up.
Better. Right.
Wow. But there is something that happens when you work with someone a few times, and Tom is a pal, and he's seen a lot of the work I've done on stage. He knows my tricks. He knows my tropes. He has a phenomenal mind, but also an attention to detail. And and what I love is that there is. It's also a weirdly lonely job, acting, because you're self-employed. You meet these whole families of people on each job, but it's always a new group of people, whereas quite a lot of the crew will work together again continuously. But what I found interesting is if you work for long enough, you then meet the same people again. And certainly getting to work with someone like Tom, who is a friend, is a wonderful thing. I mean, even actually what you were saying earlier about promoting the film, its working title, The Danish Girl, its focus features, being back here and seeing some of the people who were so supportive of Theory last year, it's actually really, it feels lovely.
It
does feel nice.
So you mentioned that you met with a number of people from the trans community, and I guess my question is, what were you able to glean from those conversations that you maybe did not from the book? And also, do you feel that the world is more receptive to a film like this today than even just a few years ago. I mean, today, this year, we've got obviously everything from Caitlyn Jenner to Transparent to a number of things, at least in the American society, that seem to indicate there's a growing acceptance of the trans community that certainly wasn't there even just a few years ago. So I guess part A, what did those conversations teach you? And part B, do you think the society is more ready for this film today?
I mean, the whole process for me has been one gigantic education and continues to be, frankly. I was really ignorant. It never occurred to me that gender and sexuality were two distinct things. I had no idea about the amount of discrimination. I mean, one of the things when I read the script that I found, you know, the amount of violence towards Lily, the amount of discrimination, the way in which the doctors in the piece pathologize what Lily is going through, was quite shocking to read. And you then, as I met women from the community now, what was astounding was sort of almost how little progress there's
really,
been.
Really.
In the United States, you can be fired in 32 states for being trans. You can... The suicide rate of trans people, of people who attempt suicide, is 41%. Healthcare issues, job discrimination. I mean, it's violence. Mm. Violence. I mean, particularly towards trans women of color, is rife. And so, what was astounding was basically in 85 years, how little
really?
Progress
wow.
there's been. Now, certainly in the past year or two, it's become a mainstream conversation, and cisgender people, including myself, are beginning to be educated and learning how to become allies to the trans community. Mm-hmm. But what I think the conversation, and of course, everything you mentioned from Transparent to Laverne Cox to Caitlin's story, is all of which, and I think particularly, you know, Caitlin's story is so unique to her. Well, it's her story.
Yeah.
And what's very interesting to me is, of all the trans women I met, and trans men, of course, there is no one trans story. Everyone has their own, but what I think is interesting about Caitlin is she's using her position of great privilege to also shine light on issues of less privileged people, and I think that there is. So it was a massive education, and I think that it's wonderful that the discussion is becoming mainstream, and I hope that this film, if it does anything, it just helps continue that discussion.
Yeah.
But there is still, it's a civil rights movement, and there is a long way to go.
Sure.
I saw a trailer for a series which I think hasn't been funded yet, but they're raising money for, called Her Story, which I think Jen Richards, I think her name
really?
Is trans actress, is in, which looks totally wonderful. Wow. I mean, in England, there has been the first sort of sitcom with Rebecca Root, who's in our film. Actually, she plays a nurse in our film. She's the lead in that, and I think there are many stories being told, and there's one woman called Paris Lees, who's a journalist in London, who I met, was I think one of the first people I met when I was researching this role, and she was describing on television the other day how she looks forward to the time when it's almost sort of boring to talk about, as when everyone is so knowledgeable that it's just part of the cause, you know, it's not something that one thinks about, and I thought that was also interesting.
Well, I mean, I guess these things can change quickly, because obviously not quickly enough for a lot of people, but the fact that today in America we have gay marriage was kind of unthinkable just 8 years ago.
Mm.
And so perhaps the society will move in that direction. But I guess one thing that people are, I'm sure, going to wonder when they see the trailer for this, when they read about it, is just logistically what it entailed for you to become, move to more from Einar to Lily, or to, I guess Lily was always
that,
within
yeah,
Einar.
Yeah.
But just in terms of, for Eddie as Einar
to
become Eddie as Lily,
yeah.
was there, I mean, it seems like it would have been makeup, hair, prosthetics, and all kinds of things. So was that, what was that like for you as an actor to do?
Well, it was important for me that there weren't any... I mean, firstly, what was interesting was that the most complex side of it was finding Lily's inner life and her emotional story. I suppose the physical... And that was from meeting trans women of different generations, different moments in their lives, and hearing their stories. And it was from them that a lot of the physical elements came. One friend of mine described how, when she was the early part of her transition, she described this phase of what she called hyperfeminization, which is when you've come out and you're sort of entering the world. She would wear perhaps too much makeup and dresses that are hyper feminine, and it was her exploring her femininity, and she related it to sort of a teenage girl's adolescence of trying things, before getting rid of some of those things as she found herself, like sort of shedding some of that. And that was interesting. That was something I wanted to bring, and I discussed with Jan Sewell, the makeup designer, and Paco, the costume designer. So you have Lily's sort of red wig, which is quite sort of prominent and strong, and then but as she finds herself later in the film, she goes back to her own hair. But one of the keys into it for me was a drawing of Lily when she was living as Einar, and it's in it the costume is one of it, or the clothing, sorry, is one of incredibly high, solid, starched collar, and then she's wearing a suit, and it is really tailored, and you sort of get this sense of, I should describe it as like an exoskeleton, like this sort of masculinity that she has imposed, or society has imposed on her. And that was a clue for me into finding her, was how to unravel those things. So that was, I suppose, was the
that's fascinating
way.
And just out of curiosity, in terms of the timing that it would entail to become, for you, I understand that Lily, Einar always was Lily, but for Eddie to become Lily, what was that?
As far as in the morning, like,
you show up.
Well, it was a long way. There was, but also things you mentioned, prosthetics. It was really important to me that there were no prosthetics. Uh-huh. There's not. I mean, there's a. Other than actually when she gets beaten and there was some stuff under the eyes and stuff, but that it was just, we were just using, you know, in the same way that I started by looking online, there are some amazing resources for trans women of vocal lessons of how to change your voice, and I started sort of following those, and then realizing actually Lily didn't have that capability or that technology, and so similarly with, we didn't want to sort of do for trans women blending, or, you know, the term passing is some which we're used to hearing is quite often sort of looked down on by some trans women, because you're not trying to pass as something else, you're just trying to be yourself. And so I didn't want it, you know, whether it wasn't, other than for playing the plot points of Lily blending at that first ball, enough for it not to look cinematically odd that everyone wasn't going, that's absurd, you know. It wasn't important. I didn't feel, oh, this is about me convincingly being a woman. That wasn't really behind the.
Right.
It was more about being her.
Right. Now you've worked with a lot of great actresses. I know just off the top of my head, the ones that occurred, you know, Michelle Williams in My Week with Marilyn, Felicity last year with Theory, Kristen Stewart, on and on. We can go on and on.
I've been very lucky.
Very lucky, and they as well. But I mean, the thing here that has, as much as, you know, people came out of this movie going nuts about your performance, but also Alicia Vikander, who this year has kind of just exploded onto the American scene, but people that were following her with The Royal Affair and some of these other international films, there's been a lot of, she's been a very interesting actress to follow. And I have to ask you, what is it, if you can pinpoint, that makes her special, and just sort of how she compares and contrasts with some of the other people you've worked with?
Well, I will never forget, Donald Gleason is a good friend of mine, and I remember him going to work on Anna Karenina and coming back one day going, I've just worked with this absolutely extraordinary woman. And so I'd heard about Alicia from then, and you're right, she's, I mean, utterly extraordinary. And pinpointing it is a complicated thing. What I found amazing, a lot is spoken of her training as a ballerina. If you see Ex Machina, you see the amazing poise and physicality in what she does. And she, I think, training to be as a ballerina, you have a rigor. That training is not easy, and it's a pretty vicious world, I think. And so she has an extraordinary strength and technical capability. But what really took my breath away was her emotional capability. Like, she has this sort of visceral thing where she doesn't she'll just out of nowhere, this extraordinary power and vulnerability will occur, and she just pushed me. I mean, really raised my game. Both Alicia this year and Felicity last year, I feel like I've been very, very lucky with the people. And you're only as good as the people that you get to play off and play with.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious to know, for you, was there one scene, if there was one scene that was sort of the most challenging for you, the most demanding for you in The Danish Girl, what would you think that was?
God, I don't know. I'm not sure about a scene specifically, but the part of the film that I found most complicated, I think, was as she was when Lily was sort of coming out, but society was repressing her. So when she was trying to retain the sort of tropes of her assigned gender in Paris, when she was being beaten, when she was that for me was, I think, perhaps the most complicated area of the film. And but at the same point, it was interesting for me because it was challenging, the film, but above and beyond everything, it felt like privilege. It did really feel getting the opportunity to play her was pretty wonderful.
And then this is sort of related, but I recognize Theory of Everything and Danish Girl, it's like apples and oranges, but as you look back on the experiences of these two, and again, I'm kind of thinking of them in the same at the same moment, because having seen them for the first time in the same setting and all of that, what did you, you know, for you as an actor, as a person, however you want to look at it, which took you the most out of your comfort zone? Which was harder for you? There's two massive transformations as an actor, and yet I wonder if you found that one was actually more of a demanding part for you than the other.
That's really interesting. I think it's so weird because it sounds odd to say, but you don't think of it in terms of you think of it in terms of doing justice to the character.
Right.
I was sort of saying before, you all, I suppose, as a human being, there is a fear element, which is the judgment. Now, as I was saying before, like the judgment was very clear in Theory of Everything because I knew that Stephen would see the film. And here in Danish Girl, it's, you know, there was what Lillian Gerda's true story. There was then the book published after Lily's life, Man into Woman, which people think is not entirely reliable. As a sort of thing. Then there's The Danish Girl, a fictionalized version, and then there's Lucinda's take on this, plus all of the trans people who I met who told me their story. So it definitely feels like more of a, you know, this isn't exactly accurate to her, the specifics of her story and things of compression. But I feel more of a sense of sort of, I think maybe it's because it's the film that I'm making now, but of responsibility to the community, really, and to trying to do justice to her story. I haven't really answered your question because I don't think I have an answer to it. But the answer is they're both very different. But again, like, our dream as actors is to get to play interesting people, and I think I've had my share in Lillian and Lillian Steven. I've been seriously lucky.
Well, it's like that great line in the movie. You know, I've had the pleasure of knowing whatever. I haven't known a lot of people that I liked in my life, but you're two of them.
I love Mateus.
Oh, what a great actor. My last question is this. You know, I think this is the one that's probably more important to you than any of these others that I've asked, which is just when people finally get a chance to start seeing this movie in theaters across the world, is there one thing that you hope they will take away from it or leave it thinking or doing differently in their own lives today, 21st century? What, you know, what would that be?
Great question. I think for me, and it's sort of become the log line for the film, which sounds, you know, the courage it takes to be yourself, you know, and that sounds so sort of grand, and but this notion of when people go, yeah, just be yourself, as if that's the easiest thing in the world. I think all of us now, what trans men and women have to go through in order to find themselves is extraordinary and deeply complicated and scary, and it involves phenomenal courage, and particularly at a time when Lily had no predecessors, it was overwhelming, the bravery that she had. That I also feel in life, like our aspiration while we're living is to try and be comfortable in our skin and to be ourselves. And I think that I hope, and love is a major part of that, and I hope that this film shows that and uses this extraordinary couple as a template of how to encourage that bravery, basically.
Well, I think that's beautifully said, and I gotta just say it's a privilege to be doing my job at the same time you're doing your job. It's so fun to cover you, and I look forward to another fun next few months. So thank you for doing this, and congratulations again.
Thanks, man. Absolutely. Thanks.